So it's up to me to kick off the SE observation section. And I'm going to go fairly fast because most of you have heard me give Susie talks many times before. But Susie, I would say that the two main science goals of Susie, which are perhaps a little different from some of the experiments taking data that you'll hear about, are that really we're primarily interested in measuring peculiar velocities via the kinematics and the Ives-Lobovitch effect. And also, we've spent a lot of time in the last 2 years investigating the issue of CMB anisotropies at arc minute scales with the hope of detecting the SC background, and have some data to present on that. I just want to, most of the work I'm presenting, my job in the last few years has been to get Susie to the telescope. Most of the analysis has been done by a bunch of other people, especially Phil Maskoff, Brooks Rand, and Marcus Runyon at Caltech and Ken Ganga. And before I move on, I just want to mention that Jeff Willick was a colleague and collaborator on this project, and a lot of you have spoken to me and expressed your sympathy for Jeff's tragic passing away, and thank you for that. I should pass those on to our department. So I'm not going to spend any time on this transparency except to remind those of you who don't know that Susie's frequency bands are 150 gigahertz, 217 gigahertz, and 350 gigahertz. We have the option, actually, of swapping this channel between 350 and about 300 gigahertz, but this is the configuration we usually use. We're trying to measure peculiar velocities at high redshift, and we think our precision is going to be set by confusion at about 300 kilometers per second. I'll talk about that in a minute. The purpose of this figure, actually, is that if you look at optical surveys of peculiar velocities like this one here, then so this is an inversion of peculiar velocity data to a redshift of about 0.025, and on this scale, that is actually this dot in the middle here, and in theory, we should be able to detect clusters out to a redshift, well, whatever redshift they exist. Here's a redshift of 1. It's questionable, of course, whether there are higher redshift clusters than 1. We have got more data now on confusion. This is estimated confusion noise to SC measurements based on SCUBA measurements of point sources. This is work done by Andrew Blaine, and basically calculates the point source contribution as a function of frequency and beam size for a whole bunch of different experiments. I added the Susie points in here. Bolacan is down here. Planck is up here. And so I use this to estimate the astrophysical confusion limit as about 170 kilometers per second for a rich cluster with an optical depth of about 1%, which is pretty low. And it's probably exceeded, this is an old figure, I apologize, but I don't think the details have changed too much. This is exceeded, of course, by the confusion from CMB anisotropies because of the identical spectrum, but that's probably about, well, for a 1% cluster, it's less than about 400 kilometers per second for a 2 arc minute resolution experiment. So that's where we get the estimate of about 300 kilometers per second for confusion from. So Susie has 4 pixels, 3 frequencies, and spectral coverage that will allow us to distinguish the kinematic SC effect from the thermal SC effect. And let's see, where am I? Jumping around a bit here. I just got this talk back because I left it in France and the view graphs are a bit swapped around, so just bear with me. The way we do it, as most of you know, this is for the benefit of those of you who don't, but each pixel on the sky, we split the incoming radiation into the 3 frequency bands. We pick off the highest frequency first, then the next frequency, and then the lowest frequency, which is 150 gigahertz. It's kind of the same idea as the frequency selective bolometer case, but except we do it with filtering. And we take a bit of a hit in optical efficiency, which might be of interest to the frequency selective bolometer people. But we get the advantage of being able to look through the same column of atmosphere at 3 different frequencies, and therefore take out the atmosphere, the contribution to the atmosphere from Mauna Kea, which is quite important. We have a beam size of about 1.5 arc minutes. The four pixels are arranged to generate two chops of 5 arc minutes. We difference this pixel from this pixel and this pixel from this pixel. And then we point the telescope and the cluster drifts through the beam and we get something. So this is actually an actual map of a point source down here, probably Mars, I think. And you can see we get these two beams on the sky, the plus and the minus. And our sensitivities are fairly well known after years of observation. In about 4 hours on a cluster, which actually covers, because of the drift scanning technique, we actually cover 30 arc minutes by 3 arc minutes in this observation. We get a sensitivity to the Y parameter of about 1.3 times 10 to the minus 5, a peculiar velocity sensitivity of about 500 kilometers per second, and our sensitivity to delta T is about 85 microkelvin in each 1.5 arc minute pixel. We have a lot of data, and we haven't analyzed very much of it. And from talking to the other SC groups, this seems to be a common feature for some reason. Mostly, I think, because a lot of us are instrument builders, and so what time we can spare from the building of our next grand instrument that's going to totally exceed what we have now, we devote a tiny fraction of that time to actually analyzing data. And also because it's pretty hard, and for a long time, also, it's been hard to get X-ray data, to get good X-ray data. And so there's a whole host of reasons, a whole host of pathetic apologies for why we don't have much data. But when we do get around to analyzing data, this is the kind of thing we get. This is Phil Maskoff analyzed A1835, and we actually wrote a paper, which has been in press for a long time. I must find out what's happened to it, but in theory it's approved, so it should be appearing. And so this is the kind of data we get. This is a scan across A1835, and so you can see the characteristic shapes due to the 2D beams. Here's this is actually how big our beam is with respect to the X-ray map. And the nice thing about SUSY is that you can get a spectrum. So here are the two SUSY points here. These are, I think these fit for different temperatures, different X-ray temperatures. So here's our 150 gigahertz point, and then this is a 217 gigahertz point. This point actually, I think, is it's one of the Carlstrom points, I think. Not corrected for point sources. I know, there's a point source in there. I don't know why that's on there. No, I understand. I didn't make this plot, by the way. It's unfortunate. No, it's we know that has the point source in it. I don't know why it's there. There's no 350 point on there because we don't extract science information from a 350 gigahertz channel. We use it as an atmospheric monitor. It's really not quite sensitive enough to give us a detection. So anyway, like I said, we've got lots of data. So hopefully in time, there will be a lot of analyzed SUSY data. And these are just some examples of the peculiar velocity measurements. We're analyzing the data in chronological order, and the instrument improved with time. So right now, the clusters we've analyzed are about 700 to 1,000 kilometers per second, but the later clusters should be a lot better. Just for fun, here's Phil's angular diameter distance diagram. Make of that what you will. That's even harder.
So I have a question. Is on any of those clusters, do you have enough data to reach your limiting amplitude for the fusion, like primary fusion?
No, because we don't do that. We don't aim to reach that limit. I decided a long time ago that the best thing to do with the peculiar velocity measurements was to go for quantity, not actual sensitivity on a single cluster. Well, we have a limited amount of telescope time. We get about 20 nights a year, which is a generous allocation from the CSO. But if we, if in 4 hours we can get to 500 kilometers per second, that means we can do a lot of clusters. And if you're trying to look for bulk flows, then the thing to do is get a lot of clusters. You don't want 10 clusters to 200 kilometers per second. You want 100 clusters to 500 kilometers per second. So we don't actually try to reach the astrophysical confusion limit. We aim for about 500 kilometers per second per cluster. But what I wanted to do, we're now in the coffee break, so I will hold your attention by showing you the stuff that you're probably most interested in, which is measurements of blank sky. We have surveyed about 0.08 square degrees to 38 microkelvin per 1.5 arc minute pixel, and we have a detection. So the way we do this is we picked three areas of sky, each 1 degree long, so we just allow the sky to drift through the beam for 4 minutes, and we get 1 degree depending on declination. And then we get a strip that's as wide as the beam, which is 1.5 arc minutes. about 100 pixels. We actually only have one row of the instrument working when we did this, which was unfortunate. But it was during El Nino, and we got probably the best observing weather I've ever seen in Mauna Kea, which meant that at 150 gigahertz, we were detector noise limited most of the time, and we got a limit that's going to be hard for us to beat. We probably reached our limit with Susie. Probably what we're going to end up doing with Susie in the future is following up on individual points. But here's an example of what we get. Okay, this is one strip. So it's, you can see it's, well, this was done at a declination of 30 degrees, I think. So it's, obviously it's not a degree. But you can see we have a bunch of structure here. And I've put some scales. So this is thermodynamic temperature, but then I put some other useful points on here. So 200 microkelvin is about a Y of 1.2 times 10 to the minus 4, and it's about 14 millijanskis. And so we have the structure is pretty much mostly on the sky, we think. This is the 1.4 millimeter channel, and you can see that by cleaning out the atmosphere, we get an RMS that's not hugely different. It's probably only about a factor of 50% worse. And we will be able to use this to try to do some spectral discrimination. And that turns out to be hard because what we're trying to do, what we would like to do, is to distinguish CMB from SC. And the problem is we only have two channels. We have 2.1 millimeters and 1.4 millimeters because our 850 micron channel just isn't sensitive enough to really give us too much discrimination. And the SZ will be very small at 1.4 millimeters because it's not exactly zero because our band bleeds some thermal effect in. But it will be small, and so we can show that there's no dust in there or no atmosphere, but it's hard for us to distinguish between SZ and CMB with any great certainty. But we do at least rule out dust emission or atmosphere. Oh, and I should say, obviously, you probably are wondering what this thing is. This is one of our cluster candidates. The red line on here is what we would have seen if we'd had a positive point source go through our beam. So you can see it's got the right sign for SZ. Just so that you can say, well, how do they know what they're seeing? This is the cross-correlation of jackknife data. So we jackknife the data and correlate it with itself, and if you see signal at zero, then it's real. So in fact, this is the signature of the cross correlation of the beam with itself. You can see we've got this, and then we have all this stuff out here, which is presumably what happens when you have several sources in your strip. You move along, you move the beam along, and you end up with another signal further along. So this gives us some confidence that this stuff is real. And then we did the simplest thing, which was probably the wrong thing. You can see the error bars start to blow up a bit at the end. So we did the simplest thing, which was the wrong thing. We just took all the data, all the fields, and we did an estimate of the band power in our window function. So this point is impossibly hard to interpret, but it's really just done to give a comparison with the 94 upper limit that we had, which appeared, I think, on right on one of Mars's view graph. So our upper limit was about here. Our 95% upper limit was here. And our result, if you take all the fields, is at about the same place, actually, which isn't really a huge surprise, because when we were doing the upper limit measurement, we knew that there was something, you know, like the 1.5 sigma level in our data, so it didn't come as a huge surprise to us when we actually redid the measurement that it came out at about the same place. If you break this up by field, what you find, I don't have a picture of it, unfortunately, but what you find is that this field, which is the one that has this big thing in it, comes up. That's horrible, but there we go. This field kind of comes up a little bit, so it's up sort of up here. And then fields where there are no obvious, one of the other fields which has no obvious single object, then it comes lower down, and their one sigma bars just touch. Okay, so you do see some effects due to this large object here. Both frequencies. I think it's from both frequencies. You actually don't get a huge contribution to the sensitivity from the 1.4 channel. Once you square the, it's about 60% worse. So by the time you square, you don't actually get a major contribution from that other frequency. Well, that's what we don't know, because we have to try to then deconvolve. We have to try and figure out what this stuff is. That's the thing. I think what we need to do with this, which we haven't done yet, is break this up into more than one band and just see what we get. Because obviously our window function... Yes, it's possible. It's... You have to be careful. I mean, the error bars here are big. Okay. Now, you don't expect zero signal from, you don't, even if it's SC, you don't expect zero. Sorry?
You wouldn't expect equal signal.
No. And you could, by eye, it kind of suggests that maybe the signals are equal. That's true.
And so you look at your guide drawing, this curve, but the point is that the atmosphere correlates to the air all together. And so what you see is the many points above one sigma is sort of an erroneous result, and figure that they're correlated with each other.
Well, except that there's not much atmosphere in here, if any. No, I don't have that with me. But you can, we have done that. You can take the beam and run it across as a matched filter, and then you can pick out the objects, and then many sigma. Yeah. The error bars here are dominated by instrument noise. We subtract most of the atmosphere. It's mostly gone. You can tell. I'll tell you how you can. I haven't got the plots, but in the 94 paper we did an analysis where you can show how much of a correlation function is due to atmosphere. And we showed in that paper that most of the noise was due to atmosphere. It's very easy to do. And when we do the same analysis on this, we show that all of this RMS pretty much is stuff that's on the sky. So there's not much at this one. Now this one does. This has a lot of, this has atmosphere in it, and that's why it's error bars are worse. So that one, yes, you have to be much more careful with. But this one, very little, if any, atmosphere in it. Yes, yes. Well, we can do that immediately by recalculating that point and just ignore this whole that whole strip. And so we still get a significant detection, but it's lower. It's more sort of down here. So it could be just intrinsic, yeah. Oh, we could get a fair amount of stuff down here. Oh yeah, no, there's definitely a possibility of a lot of it being primary anisotropy, and then some of it being perhaps seeing every one or two objects. I don't have the plot with the window function. The horizontal error bar is the half power point of the window function. Yeah, so, you know, if you consider the window function is only down to a half here. So, yeah. It's one of those frustrating results, you know, it's just a few sigma, and, you know. So as soon as you try and break it up and do anything with it, it all goes away. So. This was 10 nights of El Nino weather. About 20 nights a year. We aren't going to get more than that. I think that's it. Yeah, I'll stop there. You get coffee. In a minute, just a couple of quick questions. I'm in control. Douglas? No, just that one plot that I showed. And that, I would estimate, were probably about a factor of two or, a factor of several above the point source limit, but I have to go back through this. I think also they would probably have shown up preferentially in the higher frequency channels, depending on what they were. Yeah.
I have a vague impression that there's some data from describing transplant boundaries out in this general region. Do you know more of those data?
I don't know. I haven't heard that. Yeah. Any more? Everyone wants coffee.